caught history by starting earlier than expected. So this will make up for all the times the court is late in arriving. You've got 10 minutes. Thank you for both being here, and so we are ready to proceed on 00-0330, Landis versus Physicians Insurance Company of Wisconsin et al. And is it Happy?
Happy, correct.
Michael J. Happy representing Phyllis M. Landis. Mr. Happy?
Thank you, Chief Justice. My name is Michael Happy. I'm with the law firm of Kelly and Myberg in Eau Claire, and I'm happy and pleased, honored to be here on behalf of my client, Phyllis Landis, individually and as the special administrator of the estate of her deceased husband, Edward Landis. With the court's permission, I would like to make just a brief 5-minute argument and then respond to any questions the court may have, reserving 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
I can't promise they'll restrain from questions.
No.
We'll try.
Okay.
Not for 5 minutes.
This is a medical malpractice action arising from the wrongful death of Mr. Landis as a result of the negligence of the defendants on April 1, 1994. The issue here today is a very simple issue, and that is whether Section 655.44, Subsection 4 of the Medical Malpractice Act, operates to toll all of the statute of limitations, all the time limitations, in Section 893.551B of the Medical Malpractice Statute of Limitations, including the 5-year period of repose that's actually incorporated in and is a part of the Medical Malpractice Statute of Limitations in Subsection B. The applicable statute, Section 655.44, Subsection 4, generally provides, this isn't a direct quote, but it generally provides that any applicable statute of limitations is tolled on the date that a request for mediation is filed with the Supreme Court Office of the Director of State Courts, and that the statute, again, the statute, Section 893.551B, remains tolled for an additional 30 days after the 90-day mediation period. Section 893.55.1 is the Medical Malpractice Statute of Limitations, and it provides that one has until the later of 3 years from the date of injury, or in subsection B, 1 year from the date of discovery, not to exceed 5 years from the date of the act or omission. So the applicable statute of limitations in this case is Section 893.551B. The Court of Appeals determined that because the word repose is not contained in Section 893.551B, the tolling provision did not apply.
Now let me ask you about that, Counsel, because although the Court of Appeals may not set it, we did indicate in our Acre case, which I'm sure you're familiar with, that
very familiar.
893.551B does have both a statute of limitations and a statute of repose.
That's correct.
So this court has just last year recognized the difference, one being a statute of limitations, one being a statute of repose. How do you get around Acre?
Actually, Acre supports our position, Justice Wilcox, because the statute of repose, number one, is actually incorporated into the statute of limitations. It completes the statute of limitations that begins 1 year from the date of discovery. So it's actually it's incorporated into the statute of limitations. It's the last sentence of Section 1B. And so when you toll the statute of limitations, the statute of repose comes along with it. The other reason Acre supports our position is that in the Aker case, this court stated that statutes of repose operate to the benefit of both plaintiffs and defendants. In this case, if the statute of repose is not told with the statute of limitations, the plaintiff, Mrs. Landis, will be deprived of the full 5-year period of repose in which to bring an action because there is a statutory prohibition in Section 655.44, subparagraph 5. And that prohibition begins the date the request for mediation is filed. And so a plaintiff in Mrs. Landis' position, having filed this action within 1 month of discovery of the action, or the defendant's negligence, and having initiated the malpractice claim by filing a request for mediation with this court, the action, she would be barred during the period of time in which the parties are actually engaging in mediation and the defendants are defending the case. It makes no sense if the statute of repose does not come along with it. The other thing is that the Court of Appeals based its opinion on the fact that the word repose is not contained in the tolling provision. But the legislature has never, ever used the word repose in any statute.
Did you check that out on the machines?
I did. The word repose shows up in the annotations to the statute, but the legislature has never used the word repose.
Well, let me, you didn't quite get your 5 minutes. It was too short. Do you want more time?
If I could, Chief Justice, that would be great. The other thing, going back to the distinction between repose and statute of limitations, we don't dispute there is a distinction, but the distinction here is a distinction without a difference. It doesn't matter. The Court of Appeals in Lund versus Cocamore stated clearly that when the legislature enacted the 5-year period of repose, it enacted a special statute of limitations. That's at Lund versus Cocamore, 195 with second at 735. So when you're a practicing lawyer, you're reading the statutes, you're reading the cases, and you come across a case like Lund versus Cocamore that calls this a special statute of limitations, and the tolling statute says any applicable statute of limitations is told, what is a reasonable practitioner to do when confronted with that language?
So you're indicating you could not have filed a action before going under 655.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question.
You're indicating that you could not have filed a medical malpractice case because you chose, you were bound to go under 655.44.
Correct. The legislature provides two options to initiate a medical malpractice action. One provides that any person may proceed under Chapter 655.44 that provides for a mediation filing first. And then, if mediation is unsuccessful in an informal, inexpensive attempt to resolve the case, then, and only then, may the plaintiff file a lawsuit. And that's why it's so important that the statute of repose be told along with the entire statute of limitations. I don't think you can break up the statute of limitations from the statute of repose. Although they're two different types of statutes, they are contained within the same statute, and they are actually intertwined and incorporated into each other.
Mr. Happy, isn't it true, however, that 655.445 permits you to start an action and then go into mediation? So you wouldn't run into this kind of a problem if you took that approach, would you?
Well, you wouldn't. And in hindsight, maybe that's the way cases should go. But the language in the statute is that in Section 654.444, getting the numbers mixed up here,
okay.
In the method we chose, mediation first, the statute specifically authorizes any person, I believe those are the first words in that statute, that any person may commence an action by filing a mediation request first. And then upon filing a mediation request, the statute of limitations, which includes, again, the statute of repose, is told for a period of 120 days.
Do you really have any cases that you can cite to us, other than what you've already told us about, that would say that the statute of limitations includes the statute of repose? I understand your argument.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, what have we said that in any case?
There are no cases. And quite frankly, I think it's a strained argument to say that the statute of repose should not be told here, because when you read the statute of repose completes the statute of limitations. It's incorporated into it. But there is no case that says that a statute of limitations is a statute of repose. There are two different types of statutes.
Well, let's just talk about that for a minute. I have never quite understood what the difference is. And somewhere in this material, there's a black law dictionary definition. And the difference between a statute of repose and a statute of limitations, at least as I read the Black's Law Dictionary, was that a statute of limitations says that compute the time period from the date of accrual.
Correct.
But then the statutes define what is accrual. Different torts, different contracts, the date of accrual is different.
Sure.
So, under 893.51, the action for wrongful taking of personal property, it says the cause of action accrues at the time the wrongful taking or conversion occurs. Not when you discover, not when there's damage, etc. Now, if I understood it, the statute of repose doesn't say from a particular time of accrual. It just states, in effect, what the accrual is.
Right. It's based on the date of the act or omission.
Yeah, but it could have said, this statute could have said that a statute of limitations of medical malpractice, you ought to bring it within X number of years after the cause of action accrues or be fired, and the cause of action accrues on the date of the act or admission. That would have been a statute of limitations, because it says accrues. The magic word is accrues.
Mm-hmm.
This one says that it doesn't even use the word accrue. It says 893.55 says, one, that you have to commence it. Doesn't use accrue. 3 years from the date of injury. Is that a statute of limitations or a statute of repose?
That's a good question. I've never thought about it that way. It would appear from what you said.
No, the reason you didn't is because you accept this on the face, and I never heard of a statute of repose before I got on this court.
Chief Justice, I think you're right. Technically, that would be
a statute
of repose.
Right, the whole thing.
Right.
And it says 1 year from the date of the injury was discovered on the exercise of reasonable diligence to have discovered it, except it can't be from the date of act or omission. So the only difference here is one of these says act or omission. The other one says date of injury. Now, if you look at some of these other statutes, they don't use the word accrued. Under 893.54, injury to a person shall be commenced on action. 3 years will be barred for damages for injuries. Action may be brought for death. So I'm not so sure how the Black's Law Dictionary fits with any of these if you accept that definition of repose versus statute of limitations.
I agree. I would like to get back to Justice Crook's question about the interplay between repose and limitations. This court did say in Aker at paragraph 27, at the very end of that paragraph, that statutes of repose operate similar to statutes of limitations. to protect both plaintiffs and defendants from litigating claims in which the truth may be obfuscated by death or disappearance of key witnesses, loss of evidence, and faded memories. So really, the statute of limitations and statute of repose basically do the same thing. It's really a distinction without a difference here. One of the factors I would like to get to is that the timeline of events in this case is really critical in understanding the issue. The key dates are that on March 17th, Mr. Landis underwent a coronary artery bypass surgery at Luther Hospital, and that procedure was done without first obtaining Mr. Landis' informed consent. Reasonable information that a reasonable patient would want to know before the operation was withheld from Mr. Landis and his family. Number two, the surgery was performed negligently. Number three, the defendants concealed information from Mr. Landis and his family. And finally, Luther Hospital was negligent in credentialing Dr. McEnany in the first place and in re-credentialing him. Mr. Landis died about 2 weeks later on April 1, 1994, as a result of the defendant's negligence. In February of 1999, Mrs. Landis discovered the defendant's negligence. Less than a month after discovery, keep in mind that the statute of limitations requires that it be within a year of discovery, but within 1 month of discovery, Mrs. Landis filed a request for mediation with the Supreme Court. That notice from the Supreme Court was served on each and every one of the defendants in March of 1999, well before the statute of repose expired, assuming no tolling provision. The date of the request for mediation is also extremely significant because it was as of that date, March 8, 1999, that Mrs. Landis was statutorily prohibited from filing a complaint for 90 days. And it was during that 90-day mediation period that the parties attempted to settle in conformity with the purpose of the Medical Malpractice Act and mediation to resolve these types of cases informally, inexpensively, and expediently. So the defendants began defending this action from the date they were served with notice from this court that Mrs. Landis had initiated a medical malpractice claim. The next important date is that on April 1, 1999, that would be the date that the five-year statute of repose would expire if the tolling provision does not apply. So, because there was the statutory prohibition, Mrs. Landis could never file within the statute of repose unless it were to be told. And as I've stated, under the plain language of the statute, it clearly operates to toll the statute of repose. Otherwise, you would be barring an individual's claim during the period of time they're actually engaged in mediation. The next significant date is that the lawsuit was filed in the circuit court on July 2, 1999. And that filing took place approximately 4 months after discovery and within the 30-day grace period that is attached to the 90-day prohibition. So it was filed within 120 days of the mediation request, as is required. With that background in mind, there are 5 points I would like to cover. The first one is, it's a reading the plain language of the statutes. And I've stated this several times, but I'll say it again. In this case, the statute of repose is incorporated into and is a part of the statute of limitations. It is inseparable. It completes the last sentence of Section 893.551B. In addition, as I stated earlier, The legislature has never, ever used the word repose. In fact, if the legislature did use the word repose in this case, it would be a first, and it would also be superfluous, because the statute of repose is contained in the statute of limitations. There's no need to use the word repose. And again, I want to go back to Lund versus Cocamore, where the Court of Appeals, and Judge Hoover actually cited this case in his opinion, after saying that because the word repose is not contained in the statute, it was intended not to be told. Judge Hoover cited the Lund versus Cocamore case, where that case clearly shows, this is on page 8 of the Landis opinion, the quote from Lund versus Cocamore, that case clearly stated that the 5-year period of repose is a special statute of limitations. So because the statute of limitations and the statute of repose are integrated, when the statute of limitation is told, along with it is the statute of repose. The second point is that Mrs. Landis was statutorily prohibited from filing her complaint any sooner than she did. It would make no sense to take away a claimant's cause of action during the period of time they're actually engaged in mediation with the defendants.
Well, counsel, the theory is, whether true or not, that the legislature knows what the court is doing. It's read the opinions and taken them into account when it passed the statutes.
Correct.
And the court has used the term statute of repose for a long time, relatively long time. Now they have a statute that refers to statute of limitations are told. And yet they know the court uses the term statute of repose. So why aren't we bound to say then, assuming this is a statute of repose, that when the legislature used the word statute of limitations, it means statute of limitations. And it should and is required to adopt the court's interpretation and use of the term statute of repose, even if it doesn't use it.
The problem is that the courts have been inconsistent in labeling what is a statute of limitation and what is a statute of repose. As I stated in Lund versus Cocamore, this 5-year period was called a special statute of limitations. I don't know that the legislature really knows, with all due respect, what a statute of repose is. There's not a big distinction between statutes of limitation and repose.
Well, it was in the circuit court opinion. I think that's right. No, it's in the Court of Appeals decision, sorry. Footnote 4, which defines from Black's Law Dictionary, not from one of their cases, by the way, what a statute of repose is. Do you accept that definition? And you have to be careful, because this is where I got this accrual doctrine from. And if you look at 89304, it says, unless otherwise specifically prescribed, a period of limitations is computed from time of accrual. But then it has all these other statutes that don't deal with accrual. So it seems to think a period of limitations can either be from time of accrual, unless they otherwise say something else.
The courts have defined the time of accrual for the statute of limitations, and that is the date that the plaintiff knew or should have known that there was a cause of action. I guess the way I look at the distinction between a statute of limitation and statute of repose is that a statute of repose begins to run on a date certain and essentially ends on a date certain, but so too does a statute of limitations. I'm not sure. I don't know that the legislature knows. And looking at some of the opinions from the Court of Appeals, it's hard to know when they call this provision a special statute of limitations. The third point I'd like to make is that in this case, Mrs. Landis meticulously followed all of the statutory directives. She filed her mediation request within 1 month of discovery. She filed the complaint within 120 days of her mediation request. She followed every directive of the statute. The other thing is she followed the applicable case law. Halverson versus Tydrich, that's a case that the defendants want to avoid. That case clearly stated that the date that a mediation filing is made fixes the date on which the courts look at the timeliness of an action under Section 893.551, the Medical Malpractice Statute of Limitations, and Section 893.56. And in Aker, this court held that, or stated that, 893.56 is a 10-year statute of repose for minors. So Halverson, if you read Halverson, Halverson indicates that both statutes of limitation and repose are told. And I see that my time is up.
You may finish your sentence.
The point I wanted to make at the end here is that when a practitioner reads Lund versus Kokomor and reads Halverson versus Tydrich, and those cases say that both statutes of limitations and repose are told by the provision in 655.44, what is a reasonable practitioner to do here when they followed all the directives? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Obrowski, representing Physicians Insurance Company of Wisconsin.
May it please the court, I'm Joy Obrowski of Von Breezen, Patel & Roper, and I thank you for your time and courtesy. I guess, Your Honor, I'd like to tackle your question head on about accrual. And I'd like to take and point out that in the Court of Appeals decision,
you're going to have to stand in front of the microphone.
So I'm sorry. Your Honor.
That's okay.
What is cited is the Polchinski case from 1979, way before the plaintiffs brought their action in this case. In footnote 4, page 194 of the Court of Appeals decision in Landis. In addition, although overruled by Aker, this court addressed the distinction between statutes of limitation and statutes of repose in the estate of Makos in 1997, and then in, I'll say this wrong, Tomask, in 1998, again, this court addressed the statute of repose. Both of those cases and the distinction set out in them preceded the filing in this case by the plaintiffs. In addition,
what's the distinction, counsel?
In this court, however, has held in Aker that they are different and that accrual has nothing to do with the statute of repose. And that is also what the dictionary definition says. This court said in Aker, a statute of limitations usually establishes the time frame within which a claim must be initiated after a cause of action actually accrues. A statute of repose, by contrast, limits the time period within which an action may be brought based on the date of the act or omission. Statutes of repose thus bear no relation to the accrual of a cause of action and can toll before an injury is discovered or even before an injury has occurred.
So what if you had a statute of limitations that you have to bring this within 5 years of the act or omission?
At What if there was a statute of limitations that said that?
What if there's a statute that says you got to bring this action within 5 years of the act or omission?
Then you would have a statute of limitations that said that. But this says you must commence it no later than.
So is the secret magic word no later than?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that what this court has held in several cases is that if, in fact, Hansen and the discovery rule arose out of this principle, if the legislature gives you no guidance in terms of a specific date on which to make a judgment, then it is open for questions. But here the legislature said, didn't use accrual, said, must commence within 5 years from the date of the act or omission.
Is within 3 years of the date of injury. Now, where is the accrual issue there?
Well, the date of injury, Your Honor, can accrue even after the statute of limitation goes. And in that case, you have developed discovery rules. But here it says, we, in balancing public policy, have determined, and you have as a court determined that that public policy making of the legislature was reasonable in-state Strykowski. They have said, we are going to balance many provisions and come up with a finite date, 5 years, not from when the injury occurs, because that can be all over the place. It could be the same day, it could be a month later, it could be 10 years later, but from the date of the act or omission. And the purpose of that was not only the legislature's concern for litigation and its effect upon health care, but the effect in general upon health care, which was an interest to the public of the state of Wisconsin. Whether or not doctors order tests for litigation rather than health care. Whether or not doctors curtail the medical care they give. And this court cited that legislative intent in the Aker decision.
How do you respond, counsel, to the argument that, look, the legislature didn't use the term statute of repose. The legislature used the term statute of limitations. If they wanted to use the term statute of repose, they could have. Ergo, statute of repose is, as the Lund case says, a special kind of special, is a statute of limitations, albeit a different kind, or a special kind, I guess, is the language.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
So how do you respond?
This court has found statutes of repose consistently. Tomask is another statute in which you have found a statute of repose. Petitioner's counsel has told you they've never used that word. But I don't see why there is a distinction here. What this court must do, and what's the issue here, is what is in 655.444, subsection 4. The plaintiffs here are saying, let's leave off the words of limitations, and we'll pretend like they don't exist. Any applicable statute is what they argue in their briefs, but it's not what it says. It says any applicable statute of limitations. This court in Ball said you must give meaning to every word in a statute when you engage in statutory interpretation, and you must assume that the legislature was precise in adopting those words and giving them meaning. You can't leave off the second half.
Well, now, if you presume that the legislature is precise, the legislature has used the term statute of limitations and statute of limitations only. And the argument is, if we wanted to use the term statute of repose, we would have.
It's undisputed between the parties throughout this litigation, Your Honor, that there is a statute of repose.
Look, it's undisputed that there's a statute that limits the time for bringing the action. And the question then is, in these other cases that deal with statute of repose, does it matter whether it's called a statute of limitations or statute of repose, or is it just the effect that there's an absolute bar that was raised in all of those cases?
That is the bottom line. It's an absolute bar, Your Honor. And the plaintiff's argument that she was prohibited from avoiding that bar is not consistent with the law in Wisconsin. The plaintiff was given a choice. And in looking at the first question is, when looking at 655.445, so this petition, all of the parties agreed it was not ambiguous. Only in this petition was the ambiguity being argued here today raised. However, so if it is ambiguous, you look at the intent of the legislature and the scope of its public policy making, and you give great deference to that. When you look at what was done by the legislature here, and you have summarized that eloquently in the Acre decision, you don't only look at the words, you look at the action of the legislature. And here what the legislature clearly did, as was the opinion of the Court of Appeals, was to say, we'll give you two options. Those of you facing the statute of repose are not prohibited from bringing your action. Section 655.445 allows you to do it in conjunction with your request for mediation. Nothing about the intent of the statute is destroyed by that. Any scheduling, any discovery is on hold. So the underlying intent to have inexpensive and quick ability to resolve a case still applies. Now, if you take a look at that action, and this court talks in many cases about the actions of the court giving facts to existing law, I believe is how it's said. The action of the legislature, that is. Here, if you accept the position of the petitioners, 655.445 becomes superfluous, an nullity. It has no purpose. Everything could be satisfied by simply requesting a mediation under 655.44. The legislature here, in balancing what it was doing, as this court has outlined in Acre, was clearly giving relief to those litigants who face the potential limitation, irrespective of what you call it, 5 years from the date of the act or omission, your claim will be barred, irrespective of when you discovered it, as this court said in Acre, or when the injury accrued. So if you look at the actions and coupled with the intent, there can be no escape from that. Now, the plaintiffs say, if you read Lund versus Cocomore, Court of Appeals decision, but if you read Makos, you come away knowing there's a statute of repose. And you don't risk it, is the bottom line. You bring that action. You don't risk it. If you're unsure, you bring the action. What's lost for that? Whether you call the statute of repose or statute of limitations, what's lost? This court has, for a long time, called it a statute of repose and many other similar provisions, because that's what it is. What it is, and the court has talked about it in this way, is the courthouse doors close. They can close before you even know you have an injury and anything accrues.
Yeah, well, there's a little problem here. So far, so good. But then you've got another statute that says, hey, we want to keep things out of the court. We want to encourage people to settle their own matters, and we want to encourage them to settle it by mediation, and therefore bring mediation. And the statute of limitations is told.
But I think, Your Honor, here, and I'll try to address that. That intent is still served whether you bring your mediation request under 655.44 or 655.445, because everything's
right. Then you wouldn't need 655.445, which says there's a tolling. If you were right, you won't have to toll. You say to everybody, bring it within the limitations set forth in the statute, and then you got 15 days, in 15 days you have to ask for mediation. And that would fit your argument. You bring it, you then get a mediation. But it doesn't say that. The statute says, hey, we're going to extend, in effect, the statute of limitations, because we want to encourage you to do mediation. And you don't have to spend X number of dollars filing a fee, clogging the docket, getting a court, a judge and circuit court assigned. You don't have to do any of that. And you don't start running that meter, which brings in pretrial issues, et cetera. You don't have to do that. File for mediation, and we're putting it on hold. That's what they said. So why don't we put it on hold? Why are we, if that's the legislative policy, why are you here saying, no, you got to bring it in within 5 years?
Because I think the legislature is balancing two things, Your Honor. One is the inexpensive and quick resolution of cases through mediation, and both statutes accomplish that. The other, however, is to say, as this court said in Acre, to make a clear statement that we also believe that health care is affected by those who bring stale claims. So we're going to set two things. The statute isn't just one. We're going to say, those of you who are approaching the 5-year limit need to bring your action. You can still have the benefit of mediation, but we want to make clear that we're not going to extend these things beyond that. And this court addressed that well in Acre and the purpose of that. I think what they were doing is saying, we're trying to balance multiple things here, not just one. And we're trying to come up with a system. This court yourself said in the dissent in Strykowski, I believe, that the legislature has the right not only to develop solutions for economic difficulties, which was one of the issues here, but to experiment with that. So this may be not be perfect, but this legislature has given a course of relief to litigants who face the statute of repose. And if they choose not to do it, it has the concern of balancing what can result from that. How would you ever write a statute that took in every single exception? Well, you know, Mrs. Jones, you know, hers may be a week over or 10 days over, or maybe she's, you know, intent on negotiating mediation, maybe she's not. So they've said to prevent stale claims and to encourage the timely bringing and pursuing, we have imposed a statute of repose, which is a definite time at which the courthouse doors close, irrespective of the accrual of injury or discovery.
Can a statute of repose ever be told?
Can the statute, yes, it is automatically told by commencement of the action.
Apart from that, right, by definition, right, that does. Is there anything else that would toll it?
I think that that's a question that may come before this court in the second appeal in the Landis case. And that, I believe, the court began to look at that issue in the Acre case in terms of subsections 2 and 3 of 893.55.
Are you saying
but it's unclear.
If the legislature had said every statute of limitation and every statute of repose applicable to the lawsuit is told by a filing for mediation, that would be contrary to law? Could the legislature just say the statute of repose in section blank is told if you file for mediation?
No, I think this court has long recognized that they can make exceptions. They did make an exception.
Well, the answer then to Justice Sykes is if the legislature makes an exception to a statute of repose, that's valid statute.
I believe it's consistent with the intent of the legislature, yes. And of course, then becomes issues of constitutionality and all kinds of things. But
so the answer is only if the legislature says so.
I believe that that would, it either tolls, as this legislature assumed it would with the commencement of an action for the duration of that action, or if they specifically state statute of repose is tolled. Because the goal of the statute of repose is to set a precise deadline. It isn't dependent on discovery. It isn't dependent on when you learn your injury or when the injury occurs. Its whole goal is to say, we get a benefit from bringing an end to this potential litigation at a given time.
So once the clock is running, it is not stopped by anything.
Unless there's a commencement of the action.
Well, right.
Or a specific exception that says, we've balanced out this thing so important that it counteracts or contradicts the goal we have set in establishing this deadline.
What about subsections 2 and 3 of 89355? What about subsections 2 and 3?
I guess I would like to make clear, Your Honor, that I believe that issue will be arising in the second appeal, and I believe it would be the position of the respondents if that comes. And it's hard for me to say without anything more precise that if that comes, again, it is the goal of the legislature to set a finite date.
Would you explain to us about the second appeal? You referred to that a couple of times. Is there another appeal in regard to the same case that's pending in the Court of Appeals?
There is, in this case, a second request for appeal from the petitioners.
A leave to appeal?
No, the case is over based upon the Court of Appeals decision, sort of pending now this court's decision. Once the case was over, Judge Proctor, the trial court, ruled the case was over based upon the Court of Appeals decision in Landis. The petitioners then raised a second issue. Essentially, that issue is conformed failure to obtain informed consent concealment under subsection 2. Judge Proctor ruled that they were not synonymous. Petitioners have just started that, and that petition is, I have just moved for stay because your decision may make it totally unnecessary, and there's no way I can predict that. Depending on how you rule. I'd like to go back, though, to the purpose of the finite deadline. This court has ruled the legislature's intent is reasonable, and they have found it to be reasonable here. The legislature can set finite times in order to be consistent with its intent here to balance the right of litigants, at the same time taking in the public policy issues related to health care and the rising cost of health care associated with the results of litigation and high insurance premiums. They chose what is a reasonable time. 5 years. 5 years out, you ought to be able to determine whether or not you have, and remember, it has nothing to do with injury accruing, so that something was done wrong, that something was concealed, that the sponge is in you. If it hasn't come out by 5 years, it's not too likely for that to be an issue. They have set a finite time. Looking at the clear language of 655.44, paren 4, statute of limitations is the word used. Setting that as a statute of limitations is consistent with the legislative intent, which is established by the fact that the legislature didn't deny relief to litigants like Mrs. Landis. They simply said, if you're serious about this claim, bring it and then pursue mediation. If we buy the petitioner's argument, 655.445 has no purpose whatsoever. Now,
well, yes, it does. Doesn't it have a purpose for those people who happen to bring their action first? It provides that everything is stayed and put on hold pending mediation, right?
But that's precisely the point.
Well, I understand, but it doesn't just exist for purposes of aiding those people who are bumping up against a statute of repose.
No, but it takes care of those people so that they're not left without relief.
Right.
I mean, other people could, I agree with that, Your Honor, other people clearly could bring their action.
Right.
But it gives a recourse to those who are in a place where they must commence their action as the statute requires. And remember, the word commence is used again, specifically in the statute of repose. To commence that action. Others could do it, but this legislature, in balancing all of the concerns here, has said it's a finite deadline, but we've given you a way around it.
Sure, I understand that, but it's not rendered superfluous or a nullity if we interpret this in the manner that your opponent is suggesting.
Probably
it has
not,
other
absolutely,
purposes.
But in reality, Your Honor, there aren't too many people who bring the action first.
I have some in the circuit court.
Counsel,
is this a statute of repose or is it a statute of limitations? I'm going to read it to you. It's 893.66, and it says if you sue an accountant under any theory for damages for an act or omission in the performance of professional accounting services, the action shall be commenced within 6 years from the date of the act or omission or be barred.
Well, that's
893.66.
That's very close to the statute on surveyors that this court dealt with in.
Is that a statute of repose or is it a statute of limitations?
I believe in Tomaski called it a statute of repose because it was an absolute bar.
Okay. And then it says, well, it refers to this as. If the person suffers sustained damages and the statute of limitations applicable to those damages bars commencement of the action before the end of the period specified in sub 1, which I just read to you, then that statute of limitations applies. As I read 2, it refers to 1 as a limitation of action, which is the whole statute here that deals with all of these statute of limitations. So it seems to me, and I guess I can go through the rest of the statute, but it seems to me that the legislature is referring to these as statute of limitations or time for limiting actions, which it uses. In fact, it doesn't usually use the word statute of limitations. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't.
And I think we can get. I think we need to look at the legislative intent here and saying that here are your options. If you choose the one that you request mediation first as to the statute of limitations, and different from the statute you've just read me, there are two distinct time periods and two distinct times when the statute arises, the limitation arises. In the malpractice statute, the statute of limitations arises as of the date the injury accrues. That's been this court's holding consistently. In the statute of repose, a different date for starting the clock running is stated. That is very different than the statute the court just read to me, if I'm recalling it.
It's a different date, but, and I look at the heading, and I know the maxims about looking at the heading of the statutes, but it's a different date, but it is a date that limits an action. It limits the bringing of an action. Right, this is where I'm going, and tell me why I'm wrong on this. I look at the heading of 893.55, and you say under sub B there's both, under sub 1 rather, there's both a statute of limitations in A and a statute of repose in B. But the heading is a limit of actions. This statute limits the bringing of actions. It doesn't take much for me then to say this. This statute limits the bringing of actions. It's a statute that limits the bringing of actions. It's a statute of limitations. Limitations are limits on bringing an action. And there are a couple of genres. One genre is the, from the date of injury, is set forth in A. One is set forth in B. But they are both, however, statutes which limit the bringing of an action. Respond to that.
Your Honor, you have addressed that in case law, and that is, what you've said is that you must presume that the legislature knows what it's doing and understands the definitions in words that it uses. And limitations of actions is very different for all of us than statutes of limitations. We know what a statute of limitation does, and your presumption is that so does the legislature.
Well,
and to change it around, if I were to go in and move the trial court for a limitation of action, you'd say, that's very interesting, Ms. Ogrosky. What are you talking about? But when I go to the trial court and say, this case is dismissed because of the statute of limitations, that particular phrase has a specific meaning as defined by this statute by the legislature. And it isn't that you can switch it around. And they are clearly distinct. But most interestingly, this court has for a very long time held that they are distinct and has called the limitation that begins, the time that begins to run on the act or omission, the 5-year limit, a statute of repose.
But the legislature has never used that term. That's what's bothersome to me. I mean, maybe we're out here saying, oh, this kind of limitation of action is a statute of limitations. This kind of limitation is a statute of repose. But the legislature consistently is using the term limitation of action, statute of limitations, and apparently never, ever, ever has used this statute of repose, and yet arguably, you know, you're saying, I mean, there's lots of statutes of repose, which are limitations of actions, but the legislature doesn't use that term.
The legislature doesn't use a lot of terms that the court uses. What's happening here today is not legislation, it's statutory interpretation.
Of what the legislature intended.
Of what the legislature intended in this process.
So you're saying that the legislative intent by using the word statute of limitations is not to include a statute of repose, because they would have said statute of repose if they intended it. Isn't that your argument?
That's part of my argument. Okay. My red lights are on. May I finish, Your Honor? That is something the court said in the Ball case, but that's only part of my argument. I say the whole statutory scheme looks at this issue as a whole and its purpose. And it was to limit it, and it is not, there is not an extension. And I believe that there would be no purpose to this, as I've stated. So I believe that it is an absolute limitation, and there is no specific exception to it, and that it tolls, and it makes sense. If you start your action, it's tolled. You don't have a worry about that.
One more little quiz. This is 893.90.
Can't I claim the red?
No. An action to recover expenses by a state and the suppression of a forest fire, 893-91, shall be commenced within 2 years of the setting of the fire or be barred. Is that repose or a statute of limitations?
I don't think that you can tell here because there are not two distinctions. They're different than the one that we're dealing with.
You've got to have a two distinction in order to...
And I believe that the two distinctions are what gives rise to the fact that there are two different deadlines with two different purposes.
Well, you even have three distinctions in 893.
You have the one-year discovery rule
right.
as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
Counsel. Mr. Happy?
Justice. I want to touch upon the defendant's argument that we're claiming the statute to be ambiguous. That is not what we're claiming. If you read the plain language of the statute, it can only be interpreted the way we interpret it, because the statute of repose is incorporated into, it is part of the statute of limitations. It is the defendants that are turning this statute into an ambiguous statute. Their entire argument is based on public policy. It's based on intent of the legislature, based on looking at other statutes. That's not what you're to do here, because the plain meaning of the statute is clear. Any statute of limitations is told, and the statute of limitations includes that five-year period of repose. Number two, there is no sanctity that attaches to a statute of repose as opposed to a statute of limitations. Both statutes of repose and statutes of limitations limit causes of action. They can both be told. There's no reason not to toll both statutes of limitation and repose. And I think Justice Bradley hit the nail on the head here. The legislature... We all practice day-to-day, and statutes of limitations and statutes of repose can sometimes be clear to us, but it's clear that they're not, those distinctions are not clear to the legislature. They've never, ever used the word repose. We talk about limitation of actions, statutes of limitation. The next point I'd like to make is...
You just said something I'd like to follow up on. I think you said earlier that you had done a check and there was no reference to statute of repose presently. But then you said a moment ago, the legislature has never, ever...
Well...
Have you actually tested that out?
I have not. I tested this through a computer search on the statutes in existence today. I'm sorry, I should take that back. The present statutes do not, in any single statute, use the word repose. I apologize for that. The next point is that the defendants insist that Section 655.445 is the savior statute for people in Mrs. Landis' position. That's complete unfounded speculation. The legislature specifically authorized plaintiffs to have a choice. Either mediate first, in which case there will be a tolling of the time limitations, or file a lawsuit first. Mrs. Landis chose what she was authorized to do. She chose actually the best choice to conform with the legislative policy of informal, inexpensive, and expedient means to resolve these cases. To say that Section 655.445 is the savior, well, what about 655.44? Why did they even enact that? Why? If all you had to do was file a complaint, why have another option? And it's clear that they provided a claimant with a choice, mediate first or file suit first. If you mediate first, the time limitations are told to give the parties a chance to mediate, to resolve it without litigation, incurring lots of legal expenses, and in turn boosting the cost of medical care. The other point is that, sorry, I lost my train of thought there. The defendants claim that there is something about the statute of repose which must be followed. That there is no exception, there is no tolling, but there is. Section 893, the concealment, sub 2, 893.55 sub 2, that tolls the statute of repose, that tolls the statute of limitations.
Has that ever been litigated?
Excuse me?
Has that ever been litigated?
I don't believe it has. It may be.
That's what it sounds like.
I see my time is up.
Time is up, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Happy, and thank you, Ms. Obrowski. And that concludes our argument on 000330 Lambis versus Physicians Insurance Company versus Wisconsin.